People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. Fine Music Radio and Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. My guest is someone well known to Cape Townians, certainly. His name is Gordon Oliver, and he's just published a book of memoirs called Overcoming Life's Challenges, a personal memoir of a Cape Town mayor, including Nelson Mandela's release from prison. And let me just tell you a little bit about Gordon, who was born in Cape Town, and he holds a master's degree in religious studies from the University of Cape Town, and was ordained in the ministry of the Unitarian Church in Cape Town in 2002, and then elected president of the International Council of Unitarians Universalists from 2003-2007. He was chairman of the Cape Town Interfaith Initiative and was appointed co-director of the Parliament of the World's Religious, held in Cape Town in 1999. But he was also elected mayor of Cape Town from 1989 to 1991. And he had the privilege of welcoming Nelson Mandela to the Cape Town City Hall on the day he was released from prison, an historical event indeed. Gordon, welcome
Thank
to
you.
Fine Music Radio. You were on the board here for a while, weren't you?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And you said you knew Leslie McKenzie for ages.
Yeah, sure.
And Mark Jennings.
Yeah.
Can you remember how long were you on the board? Was it a fairly long time?
It was at least 4 years.
Okay.
If not slightly longer.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad, as you said, you still listen to Fine Music Radio. So, Gordon, this book, first of all, just what made you write it? Did someone persuade you? Did you feel you needed to write it? Because it does have a very personal feel to it, as your subtitle suggests.
I'd always wanted to write. I've been pretty good at writing and enjoyed writing essays and correspondence and so on. And I wanted to write my story for my family, for my children. Mm-hmm. I've got four daughters, all grown-ups, and I felt that they would want to have some record of my life. And that was my first intention, and I always thought, one day I'll do that. One day, one
as
day,
one does.
One day, one day never comes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I then also, having done the master's degree in religious studies, I wanted to translate that or transfer it into a lay language rather than academic language. And I realized, well, I've got two assignments that I want to do: write my story and rewrite the master's degree. And I thought, well, where do I start? And I thought, well, the family come first. But I also wanted to write that master's degree, rewrite it. So I decided to combine them. And so to some extent, that's a combination of the degree and my family story.
Both of which are in this book.
That's right.
I'm interested to know, just tell me, you were born in Cape Town, as we said. So Cape Town has been your home.
Well, actually, I was born in Bloemfontein. And the story is there, and it's quite a story. But
yes.
I've lived all my life. My family lived in Cape Town and happened to be in Bloemfontein at the time of my birth.
Uh-huh.
So, but yes, I've lived all my life in Cape Town.
And can I ask you, when one goes through the book, like the chapters headings that you've got here, you go right from your birth in some detail, your parents, your early education, and then politics entered your life. How did that happen, that politics came into your life?
I was a child of 13. I'd always been in boarding school and would come home on holidays, and I was about 13 when the apartheid government was just getting into its stride. I'm talking now of about 1948, 49, whatever.
When the Nats came into
that's
power
right,
first
that's
time,
right.
Yes.
And I was remember being at home on holiday, and the Nats were just getting into their stride by removing coloured people from the voters' roll. And my tiny mind of age 13 knew nothing about politics. But it was a tremendous horror. I thought, if when you play a game and you change the rules because you've lost, that's immoral. It's not right. And I thought, that's exactly what the Nats are doing. They're changing the rules. And I was horrified, and listening to the family talking and so on, I became very interested in what was going on at that young age.
That is very young, isn't it? 13, yeah, I think so. To be so aware.
Sure.
So, was your family interested in politics?
No, other than just average people talking about what was going on.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Horrified at what the Nats were doing. So I became actively involved when the Nats decided to convert the Union of South Africa into a republic. And I was very aware of that. And, of course, I voted. I was 19, and I voted in that election. And then the Progressive Party became involved, became active, broke away from the Unita Party. And I marched down to Dumbarton House down here in Adley Street, paid my 5 shillings and became a member.
Of the Progressive Party.
Yeah, and before long I was on a committee in Greenpoint where I lived. I got involved and I was nominated for the committee. Mm-hmm. I became active and active ever since then.
That was 1920, your early 20s?
No, I was in my early 20s. That was in 1951.
Okay. 50s. So now we're talking about...
The 60s.
Yeah, 60s. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you got involved so early on in part of conferences and, you know, working with...
Yes.
You obviously had that in your blood.
Sure. You know, I was attending party meetings, house meetings and so on. And I remember being called upon when somebody had given a speech, and I was called upon to say a word of thanks. And I remember I said my word of thanks, and a fellow committee member said, "Oh, you're quite a speech maker, eh?" And I thought, "Oh, that's not bad for me." And so that's kind of prodded me along the way, and got very active, became party chairman at some stage, and I was...
All with the Progressive Party.
Yes, and then of course the Progs became the Democratic Party and so on.
Right.
So I was active all the time, right the way through my life, until after I finished with the mayoralty. I thought, no, this I was then well into my 60s, and decided, no, that's enough now. Step down and let some younger people get involved.
I want to find out in a moment about the religious side of your life and where that came from, because it obviously ran parallel.
Yeah.
But first of all, let's take a first piece of music, Gordon, and you've chosen Elgar's Chanson de Matin, a lovely little piece. Is there a special reason for this piece?
Yes, I'm quite proud of this. I was in my 50s then and mowing the garden lawn in the front garden. And I was busy mowing away, and I'd switch the machine off every now and again to do whatever I needed to do. And opposite me lived an elderly gentleman playing this most beautiful piece of music. So I stopped the mowing of the lawn, and I went across the road to say, what's that nice piece of music? And he told me what it was. Oh, I said, and I immediately decided I wanted a copy of that music. So I went along to the Reader's Digest with a little tape cassette, and I bought a tape cassette with that music on it. And I was so enchanted. And so that's how I got involved with, I suppose, serious music,
but not
an expert. But and then Fine Music Radio. I was so delighted that Fine Music Radio was founded, because the sort of music of the day was the sort of Chubby Checker kind of Elvis Presley and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, well,
not up your
this
street.
Is not, absolutely not.
Okay.
I couldn't stand this stuff. So
okay. Well, let's listen to...
I'd found a home.
A home. Let's listen to Chanson de Matin.
Thank you.
Indeed, a beautiful piece by Sir Edward Elgar, a short piece, that Chanson de Matin, the Song of the Morning.
Correct.
And it was the first choice of my guest on this week's edition of People of Note, Gordon Oliver, who's written a memoir called Overcoming Life's Challenges, a personal memoir of a Cape Town mayor. We're going to come to Overcoming Life's Challenges in a moment, but as I said, we worked out how you got involved in politics and public life there with the Progressive Party, going on looking for votes and things. But what about the religious side? Because that obviously started quite early as well. So tell me about how you became, how you came to get a degree in religious studies.
I was, during the war, my father joined up to go to Italy, and he was away for quite a while, and my mother was had to be a working mother. So I was farmed out to some very close friends of my mother's, who lived in Weinberg, and they were ardent Catholics. My family weren't religious, but the family that I was, where I was boarded, I suppose, were devout Catholics who asked my parents whether they could have me baptized in the Catholic Church. And so they agreed, my parents agreed. And of course, it's well known that Catholics require, the church requires, that where a child is baptized, he or she needs to be brought up in the Catholic faith. And this family adhered to that. I was with them for a year or two, I think. And so I was baptized in the Wedderboom Catholic Church, and I was sent to a Catholic boarding school. First the Holy Cross Convent in Maitland as a little nipper, and then at the age of eight I was raised by the Salesian Fathers, where I was schooled for the rest of my life in Lansdowne Road. And I became a very devout little Catholic. And when I left school, the world hit me. I was a boarding school, and the world hit me in the face. And I continued going to Mass in the local chapel up in Villa Maria. And after about a year, I got bored with it all. And I stopped going to church for about a year, for about 10 years. But I always knew I ought to go back to church. And I felt, no, I can't go back to the Catholic Church because I've been missing Mass and eating meat on Fridays and all that kind of thing, you know, that Catholics have to observe. And so I went to the Methodist Church in Seapoint, where there was the Reverend Reverend Theo Kotzer, a devout liberal Christian, and I was very taken up with him, and I joined the Methodist Church, and I was a Methodist I was a Catholic, and I stopped going to church, to the Christian church, for the rest of that time in my life, and at the age of about 50, I found the Sufi movement delightful, pleasant, beautiful place. It was my first exposure to interfaith worship. And then later, about to become mayor, the Sufis don't have chaplains and ministers. So I thought, well, I needed a chaplain the mayor has to have a chaplain to lead the council in prayer and so on. And so I found Bob Stain, a Unitarian minister. So I became a Unitarian for the wrong reason. I needed a chaplain. But I decided I should go and visit Bob Stain and go to his church and listen to see what's going on there. And I was enchanted with the freedom of worship concept. And so I've been a Unitarian ever since then. And but I've been very multi-faith. I'm easy with all faith, interfaith work. And I was very involved in the interfaith movement as chairman at one stage for a long time.
Are you ordained?
Yes. We don't use the word ordained because it's a very Christian word. And but yes, I did a bachelor's and honours degree in religious studies, and then I did a master's degree at the University of Cape Town. So it's still part of my life, but I'm retired. I'm not active anymore. I sit in the back row, and I wag my finger at the minister if he or she is going astray. You know?
Where does the Unitarian Church sit? Is it similar to the Methodist? Is it completely different? Is it completely interfaith?
It's an interesting question. It has a long history going back to the days of the Reformation. So we come from the Christian tradition. We're not known as Christians. We're free thinkers, but we, as I say, come from the Christian tradition, and the emphasis is freedom of choice, honoring and respecting all religions. Mm-hmm. We don't judge other religions. There's no wrong religion.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And this is why you say you don't use the word ordained. Yeah, although in a sense, as we, as a Catholic and Anglican, would think, you have been ordained into Unitarian Church.
Even though I'm formally received into the Unitarian Church, having undergone formal training. Yeah. Okay. So my training was within the Christian tradition, mm-hmm. By way of a bachelor's and honors degree. But yes, it's a very open and free religion.
Okay. Gordon, your next piece of music, by contrast, is Glenn Miller and his orchestra, yes. Alice Bluegown. Tell me how this landed on the list.
Yes. You know, my mother, when I was a little nipper of about 7, purchased or acquired a pianola.
Oh.
It was a delightful acquisition in my family. My two sisters picked up, did formal training, musical training, became pianists, and I used to love to play this thing during school holidays. And my mother, her name was Alice, and she loved this pianola too. And one of her songs that she loved was Alice Blue Gown and Little Old Lady and all those sort of songs, and all They'll Always Be in England. And
yes, all that era, yes.
And so Alice was her name. And I chose that because, in her honor, she was a good soul and a happy, happy soul. And this is in her honor, Alice Bluegown.
Thank you.
Glenn Miller and his orchestra, distinctive sound, certainly, and that was called Alice Blue Gown. It was the second choice of my guest on this week's edition of People of Note, Gordon Oliver, who's written a book called Overcoming Life's Challenges, a personal memoir of a Cape Town mayor. And so we've covered, Gordon, your entry into politics and your entry into religion. Sorry to use that word again, religion. But tell me the story about how you ended up becoming mayor of Cape Town.
I joined the Ratepayers Association in Plumstead. I lived in Plumstead in those days. I was a family man, and we moved into Plumstead, and we were approached by neighbours across the road to sign us up. Now, being political, I knew what was all about. So I eagerly joined to become involved, and who knows what happens. Mm-hmm. And we had a councillor who was very conservative. I got onto the committee, and I joined and became involved. And this very non-political councillor, who just wouldn't take a stand politically when it came to local politics, he was very neutral. So we felt, handful of us youngsters, cheeky youngsters that we were, we decided he needed to be replaced. And we looked around, elections were coming up about a year or 18 months beforehand. We need a replacement. We couldn't find anybody who wanted to take it on. And I and a close colleague, two of us both on the Ratepayers Association, agonized and tried to find somebody. And we eventually, I decided, well, why don't I give that a go?
Yes, what about me?
Yes, you know, but then I said to myself, no, you've got no experience. The people, I'm not a public speaker and this, that, and the other thing. And I was constantly finding ways and means to put myself down. And so one day I was walking the dog one night, agonizing over who do we get, and I said, I'm going to do it. And so I put my name forward, to the horror of all the local ratepayers, I thought, and I stood for election, and I won hands down as a city councillor. I doubled the opponent's vote, and he was out. I then was on the council for about a total of 15 years, and after about 7 or 8 years, same story. I saw one mayor after the other being inaugurated, and I thought, wow, I'd love to be mayor, but I'm not good enough, and forget about it.
Did you really think I'd love to be mayor?
I said to myself, I'd love to be mayor, because it's a wonderful experience being inaugurated and all the hullabaloo and the
very grand.
Yes, absolutely. But you won't matter. And same story. There was a mayor who was outgoing. His term was up. Another colleague put his name in the hat. And the same story, some of us said, no, he's not the right man. Same story went by, and after about 8 months, same story, I put my name in the hat. And so there were two candidates now, both running for mayor. The formalities of becoming mayor are very simple and yet very formal, and there were two of us in the hat. And we were convinced that Joe Soap wouldn't make it. And I said to a colleague of mine, just out of the blue, I'm going to do that. I want to do that. And I did. I put my name in the hat, and there were two of us. And it was, one had to canvass amongst the other 32 councillors and really impress, you've got to impress them and make them vote for you. And so the election took place, and I really didn't think I'd make it. I thought the other guy would make it. And the tradition was the outgoing mayor, still in office, because he was outgoing, the tradition was that the losing candidate's name would be mentioned first. I don't know why. And then the winner would be announced second. My name was called first. Oh, I've lost. The vote, there were 34 councillors. I had to get 18 to win. I won 24 out of 34.
Yeah.
I'd won. First name in the hat, drawn. Oh, what a relief. And my colleague, obviously, was very gracious in having lost. And so that's how I became mayor, and it was largely for political reasons. We wanted to oust this man, prevent him from being mayor, and we couldn't find anybody. I put my name in, and I was mayor. Deputy mayor for 2 years, and then full mayor for another 2 years. So you served 4 years in the mayor's office. So that's how I became mayor.
And you were mayor at quite an interesting time because the country at that stage was going through awful times politically and violence.
That's right.
And you there...
Very political, as I say, very political.
Yes, and that was your reason, wasn't it? Right. To want to get in, to get rid of the people who shouldn't have been there. And apart from the fact that you were involved with Nelson Mandela's release from prison, which we'll come to, there was that very famous march, wasn't there, in September 1989. Just tell me briefly about that.
Yes, I was deputy mayor. It was the last week of my deputy mayoralty. I had heard from the cathedral, the dean of the cathedral, that a visitor there had been a parliamentary election a week before my inauguration. And the nationalist government had called the election, obviously, and because non-whites, they had no vote. The huge protest all around the country. In Khayelitsha, the police had killed about 24 people for protesting illegally, and the cathedral called a service of mourning to mourn the loss of those people the same day that I was inaugurated as mayor. I knew about the killings. I was fully in the picture. But because it was my day of inauguration, I thought, I won't be able to go to the service of mourning, because that was the inauguration was in the morning. But the service of mourning took place in the afternoon, and I happened to be free. And so I decided I'd walk up to the cathedral and just sit in the back row as a newly installed mayor. And they saw me sitting at the back there. I wasn't looking for publicity. And they called me up and sat on the main platform with all other bigwigs and ANC people and whatever. And when the service ended, the Archbishop of Cape Town, Tutu, announced there would be a protest march to Parliament the following Wednesday. Today was Friday. The following Wednesday would be the march. And the press were present at this service of mourning. And I found myself a microphone in my face. Mr. Mayor, will you take part in the march? I hadn't thought of it. It wasn't on my plan. I had decided that I would become publicly supportive of non-white people in favor of the protesting. So I had taken that decision, and I said to the press, yes, I will take part. And the next morning, Saturday morning, they were still published in the Cape Times in those days on Saturdays, the press front page, the mayor to protest march. My phone that Saturday, Sunday, and early Monday morning didn't stop ringing. And so that's how I got to be involved in the march. And all hell broke loose.
Yes.
And it was very, very exciting.
Yeah, exciting.
Wrong reason to protest.
But excitement. Still, yeah. Now we're going to have another piece of music, Gordon. Long Before the Night, The Ancient Love. What is this all about?
This was a song that I picked up when I was in, as a Unitarian, picked up when I was in Boston. The headquarters of the American Unitarians happened to be in Boston, and I happened to be a brand new minister, and I picked up this CD from their bookshop. A lovely piece of music, very, very moving, very exciting, and it became almost a song of mine. I took it on and bought the CD, and so it became my copy, I suppose, and I still have a copy of the CD. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's listen. This Ancient Love. Thank you. This Ancient Love, Long Before the Night, an interesting piece selected for us by Gordon Oliver. We're talking about his life as a minister in the Unitarian Church. Also, a personal memoir of a Cape Town mayor is the title of his book. And on the front page, you've put here on the cover, including Nelson Mandela's release from prison. So apart from the September 1989 march, that must have been quite a day with you as mayor of Cape Town. I mean, it was bordering on hysteria that day. Did you go to Victor Verster, or did you meet him at the City Hall, or how did it work?
No, I was invited to go and see him at Victor Verster, but the prison authorities said it was there too many people coming and going. You know, just wait, we'll let you know. So, but the ANC, not yet in power, but ready now, you know, to get active, they decided to bring Mandela rather than take him to Soweto, to City Hall, to Cape Town. And I think I was sort of in their favor. I imagine, perhaps I've been a bit unhumble in that observation. But I had lots of contact with Tutu and their colleagues. And so there I was about to host the city got active early that morning, and laid out all the rigmarole on the Grand Parade and everything. And I was there very early. And the main objective was to obviously welcome Mandela, and but we were concerned about his security, safety. So we decided that rather than bring him straight to the Grand Parade, we would be in touch with the traffic police from the mayor's parlor on air, and follow his progress into the city. And of course, as you know, he took forever to get there.
It was due
at 3 o'clock, and he arrived after 5. And there was a huge concern about his safety and about the safety of the public. There was the beginnings of some hysteria and some trouble. So I decided that instead of meeting him at the city hall on the balcony, where I would meet him at the back entrance, where the choir people and they come in, they're up from the back, the side street, and I went down there, and there the car rolled up. Great anxiety, so the crowd, because he's visible from the crowd from the Grand Parade. So I went down there to make sure that I could get him in as quickly as possible, and he's jumped out of the car, and I ran towards him, and in my enthusiasm I reached out for my arms to give him a hug. I like hugging. So this former prisoner got a hug. I'm not sure. Perhaps he was hugged by the first time being hugged by a white man. I don't know. But I'm talking nonsense now.
But a lovely story, Albert.
And he looked at, there's the photograph of him, shoulder over, face, head over my shoulder, looking towards the camera, and me hugging him from the rear. And
that photograph, I think, is
yes,
in your book.
Yes, it's in there.
It's on the back page.
Yes, well, it's also in the book.
Yeah.
And so we rushed upstairs onto the city hall. And meantime, there'd been a lot of Alan Busack and others keeping the crowd calm. My new deputy mayor, Frank van der Velde, who you know probably, Frank and I were obviously the sort of hosts, with lots of people in the city hall, hundreds of them in the mayor's parlor, and because it was so hot, it was exceptionally hot, Frank, in his good-heartedness, decided to get. There was a shortage of water; the water had run out, and so he knew that there were fire hoses in the city hall, down the, but these fire hoses hadn't been used for 100 years or something.
Yes.
And of course the fire hoses, there was Frank, trousers rolled up because the water rushing down the corridors, and Frank with his trousers rolled up, dressed in a deputy mayor's tie, taking care of all the people who needed water. So that was a lot of fun. And when Mandela arrived, I saw that he was up there, and I was on the balcony as well. We then came back into the mayor's parlor, and there were drinks and sandwiches served, and I gave him a little speech very mayoral and welcome to Cape Town and blah, blah, blah. And then somebody turned up unannounced before Mandela arrived, while the crowd was restive and going bananas. A black car turned up, fancy black car, slowly onto the grand parade where there were thousands and thousands of people. It was Jesse Jackson, the would-be mayoral candidate in the United States.
Exactly.
Always looking for photo opportunities. Yes. He couldn't get out of the car because there were a million people around the car. Mm-hmm. He was jam-packed in the car. So the only way he could get out was to roll the window down and climb up onto the roof and clamber up the railings of the city hall.
Good
into the city, into the mayor's parlor.
Yeah.
So there was huge laughter and going on. So it was very funny, and it's all mentioned in there. And so it all lasted many hours. And off he went.
But what a wonderful highlight to have been mayor of Cape Town at that momentous occasion.
Absolutely. I was very privileged.
And there's the statue there today where he did his speech.
That's right.
And then you left, but just quickly, in the few minutes we've got left, you also did a fair amount of traveling as mayor, didn't you?
That's
to meet mayors of other countries and other cities.
Cities, and likewise the reverse mayors coming here. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, as mayor of Cape Town, was it an enriching experience? And what a privilege, as you said, to be mayor of a city like this.
Yeah.
In those tumultuous times.
Sure, yes. It certainly was. And it was David Blumberg, who was a former mayor, he's also mentioned there, former mayor many years before, had recommended to the executive committee of the council that the mayor, me, should travel overseas to fly the flag for Cape Town as a non-apartheid city.
Right.
Opposed to apartheid.
Yes.
Well, of course, apartheid was enforced, but not at our cost.
Yeah.
You know. So I was sent to Paris. Bonn was still the capital of Germany. And also Abidjan in Ivory Coast to fly the flag. And then 6 weeks later, I went to London and Washington and New York, Atlanta.
But what a lovely
experience
you had.
Yeah, flying the flag. And that two trips, 3 weeks and another 3 or 4 weeks, at San Francisco and Vancouver, tremendous experience, and being hosted and I've got the record, the full record of that those two. Yeah. two
One of your chapters, chapter 9, Letting Go and New Beginnings.
Yeah, yeah.
That was when you left being a mayor.
That's right.
And embarked on the other interests.
Yes,
in
sure,
life.
Sure. That was a personal, what we call. A vision quest. It's run by a couple, lovely two women, and it's been going for years and years. And it has its roots in find your mountain, find your soul. And I'd been in the public eye for decades,
yes.
And I needed a break, and I needed to find myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a 12-day experience, of which 4 or 5 days out in the mountain. Alone, fasting. It was a wonderful experience. And
But Gordon, what a life,
may I say.
A personal memoir of a Cape Town mayor. And this is the subtitle of his book, Gordon Oliver's book, Overcoming Life's Challenges.
Is there time to talk about that quickly?
Yes, if you are.
The first title of the book was Echoes of Memory. Book was published in full color. The publisher said it's too expensive. We have to reprint it. But you can't use the same title. Oh, says me, I've got 48 hours to come up with a new title.
Oh, dear.
And they came up with, my book reviewer said, that's a clunky title.
And this
think,
one?
This, yes.
The new one.
And I think it is. But it's okay. My daughter's both, I've got 4 daughters and they all approve of
yes.
the title.
They think well, it's still.
They say it's going to draw readers.
Yes.
Well, I hope so.
Well, you had a good launch at Exclusive Books
yes,
a while ago.
Yes, that's right.
And it tells you what the book's about, Overcoming Life's Challenges, a personal memoir of a Cape Town mayor.
That's right.
So you're allowed to keep
that's
it.
Right.
Gordon, Oliver, it's been great talking to you and finding out about your role in the city, both in the Progressive Party as it was then, as mayor, and all the other things you've done. So thanks. And you want to end with the Holy City, that rather beautiful song. Is there a special reason you've chosen this apart from its beauty?
As I said, it was one of my little Holy City, Holy Joe favorite pianola. And that's where it started. And I love singing that. I won't sing it for you, but and it's always been a favorite of mine wherever I've been. And I've kind of thought of it as maybe the city is, as there's a sanctity and a beauty about the city.
That's a nice thing to say and to end with, the Holy City. And singing it for us here is Thomas Allen. Gordon Oliver, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Last night I lay sleeping, there came a dream so fair. I stood in old Jerusalem beside the temple there. I heard the children singing, and ever as they sang, methought the voice of angels from heaven in answer rang.
Sure. People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.